I'd like now to welcome to the Radio Cafe Ladd Everett. He is with the Coalition to Stop Gun Violence. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So there is so much to talk about that it's going to take us probably a couple of days here on the Radio Cafe to really do this subject justice, because it has such a long history in the United States, the question of guns and the use of guns. Let's start with this whole question of the Second Amendment and the meaning of the phrase well-regulated militia. Can you tell us a little bit about the history of the Second Amendment and what its original intention was?
Yeah, you bet. I mean, well, for starters, what predates the Bill of Rights, of course, is the Constitution itself. And the Constitution was drafted by Federalists, men who believed that only by strengthening the federal government could we preserve our Union, which was at that time in trouble under the Articles of Confederation. And when they drafted the Constitution, the primary author of the document, who was also the author of the Second Amendment, James Madison, gave extensive control to the federal Congress over the state's militia. Basically, the Constitution said that the federal Congress could organize, train, and equip the militia. And some anti-federalists and states' rights actors made, I think, what was a valid point, that if they could arm the state's militia, what would prohibit them from simply not supplying arms, thereby disarming the state's militia and leaving the states vulnerable in terms of internal security and possibly external security. So with the Second Amendment, Madison was basically making a compromise. He was basically saying to anti-federalists, if you will agree to support the Constitution and help us ratify this document, this new system of government, I promise to immediately go back to the drawing board and create a new Bill of Rights that will provide for individual and states' rights right after the ratification of the Constitution, and basically assuage your concerns. And with the Second Amendment, Madison was trying to properly balance military power between the federal government and the states by making sure that individuals who are privately armed would supply weapons and firearms for the state's militia. That was the ideal. In practice, it didn't always turn out that way. There were many pieces of legislation, even shortly thereafter, where the federal government did have to step in and arm those units. Their discipline, their organization, their level of armament wasn't always up to snuff. But that was the ideal. Today, the situation has changed dramatically in many ways. One of the primary motivations of the Second Amendment, of course, was a fear of federal tyranny, potential federal tyranny, because of the fact that under the Constitution, the federal government could now raise a standing army. And, of course, today, no one fears a standing army anymore. In fact, if you look at national opinion polls, the U.S. military is literally the most trusted institution in America in poll after poll. And, you know, an even greater irony, perhaps, is that the well-regulated militia of today, our organized militia, of course, is our National Guard, is entirely armed by the federal government. No one buys an AR-15 at a local gun show and then goes out to serve in Iraq. It just doesn't work that way. So really the motivations that drove the Second Amendment, you know, it really are anachronistic. These are concerns that really no longer exist in modern-day America. And, of course, the type of militia units that existed at that time, really citizen militia, it no longer exists.
What did those state militias at the time do? What was their role?
Well, they did a lot of different things. I mean, one thing to realize, of course, right off the top is that there were no organized police departments at that time. So the militia served that type of basic internal security role. And, you know, the militia also supplemented what standing army we did have at that time, which was relatively small. So they fought in our nation's wars. And, you know, then there were other things they were involved in, of course, like, you know, fighting Native Americans in those battles. You know, if you had a bear in your yard, you might call the militia out. Putting down internal rebellions was a chief role of the militia and a purpose of the militia, as stated in the Constitution. So they had a very broad range of roles in terms of providing for internal and external security for our country at that time.
One of the frames that folks like the National Rifle Association use is that guns equal freedom, and it's almost like the opposite of what you're saying about the Second Amendment, and that is that we need to be free as citizens to take up arms against our government. But that militia concept was the government? It's sort of confusing.
Yeah, well, you know, I think you've hit on something that's important, and that's that really the core idea driving the modern pro-gun movement is this is what we call the insurrectionist idea. They promote what we consider a very radical and perverse idea that the Second Amendment gives individuals the right to essentially shoot and kill government officials when they personally sense tyranny. Again, this is an utter perversion of what our founders believed. One of the important things to realize is that one of the chief motivators to draft the Constitution in the first place was the level of internal rebellion we were seeing in our country at that time. Shays' Rebellion is the most notable of these incidents, but there were a lot of riots and rebellions across the country at that time, and the federal government was simply so weak it could not act to put them down. This was of tremendous concern to James Madison himself, who described Shays' Rebellion as a warning to our nation. And when he drafted the Constitution, there were several provisions that were put in there to address the threat of domestic insurrection. Of course, as I stated previously, one of those was that a stated purpose of the state's militia in the Constitution is to, quote-unquote, suppress insurrections, not to foment them, to put them down. And then, you know, there were other provisions in there as well that talked about providing, you know, a buffer against domestic insurrection. And then, of course, the definition of treason in the Constitution in Article 3, Section 3, which is the only crime that's defined in that document. So, you know, the founders spoke against this very strongly a few years after the Second Amendment was ratified, just 3 years after. General Washington himself rode out at the head of 13,000 state militia to put down the Whiskey Rebellion. So this is not something that they trifled with or were equivocal about. They were very clear that under the existing Constitution, individuals and armed mobs did not have the right to take up arms, you know, against our government when they disagreed with democratically enacted laws.
So, cutting now straight to the present day, how do we here in the United States compare to other countries in terms of gun ownership and in terms of death by gun?
Well, we have, you know, the United States has more guns per capita than any country on the face of the earth. And if you compare us to other modern democracies, we have a rate of gun death that's astronomically higher than other modern industrialized democracies. And we also have an overall homicide rate that's far higher than other modern democracies. You know, the argument from us would not be that guns cause crime. Guns do not cause crime. What they do, however, is make attempted crimes and attempted suicides far more lethal. It's the difference, you know, the obvious difference between, you know, two young men having a fist fight and two young men having a duel with guns. You know, obviously one type of situation is going to be far more lethal than the other.
Even a knife fight is relatively benign in comparison.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. And that's, you know, you can compare us, for example, with a country like the United Kingdom, where we have a gun death rate that's more than 30 times higher than theirs. And then if you look at the overall homicide rate, our overall homicide rate is more than 3 times higher. So it's not that people in Britain are not trying to kill each other or not attempting homicides. It's that when they do not have as lethal means at hand as we do here in the United States, where we facilitate the arming of people who are even clearly dangerous or clearly unbalanced.
When we talk about death by gun, how many of those deaths are from police killing people versus citizens killing each other?
The overwhelming majority are by citizens killing one another. I think the number of deaths concerning police killing others would be, I believe, around maybe 1 or 200 at most. I'd have to check it. But, I mean, the overwhelming majority of the, I think it's approximately 17,000 or so homicides in this country each year are involved citizens.
So when we look at these kinds of homicides, and there's also, we can talk about suicides and accidental killings as well, but what kind of guns, I mean, we're hearing so much about assault weapons, what kind of guns are most common in gun deaths in the U.S.? Are they assault weapons?
No. Overwhelmingly, the gun of choice for murderers in this country is a handgun. If you look at homicides in America, two out of every three involve a firearm, and one out of every two involve a handgun. So the weapon of choice overwhelmingly for murderers in this country is a handgun, and that certainly makes some sense because it's compact and concealable, easy to carry around. And also, you know, given gun technology today, packs quite a bit of firing power.
If that's the case, why is there so much focus on assault weapons in this debate right now?
I think for two reasons. I think number one is because they're becoming such commonplace tools in mass shootings in this country. There's an increasing prevalence of assault weapons in these shootings, and in particular, high-capacity ammunition magazines, which are really a feature now in almost every single mass shooting we're seeing. And then the other reason, which I think is salient, which we don't talk enough about, is what we talked about a minute ago, which is that assault weapons are overwhelmingly the weapon of choice for insurrectionists in this country, people who are literally preparing for war with our government. And that's a problem that that we need to begin discussing.
Can we talk about that a little more? Who are these folks? I have to say, I don't know them personally. Who are they? Where do they live? What do they want? What's going on?
Well, I mean, I think you have to understand that for more than three decades now, the National Rifle Association and other pro-gun groups have been radicalizing their base and telling them that basically the government wants to go to war with them, wants to forcibly confiscate all guns in America and then literally enslave them. And I think it's radicalized that movement and driven people to a stance where they view their own government essentially as an enemy that they must prepare for war with. I want to make it clear here. This certainly does not represent a majority of gun owners. This is a what I would consider a small minority of gun owners in this country. Because if you look, for example, at NRA members, you know, you can see that, for example, 75% of them support background checks on all gun sales. By and large, these are reasonable people that, for the most part, don't buy into this ideology. But if you look at pro-gun organizations and the people leading these organizations, like, let's say, Wayne LaPierre of the NRA or Ted Nugent, a longstanding NRA board member, you'll see a lot of insurrectionist rhetoric coming from them. And I think many of those folks do buy into it. And I think they've certainly radicalized their base, people who are not necessarily gun owners, but more pro-gun activists, people who are working this issue 24/7. And that's really become the core belief among that group.
We're talking to Ladd Everett of the Coalition to Stop Gun Violence. So do these ideas have any rational basis in reality that you are aware of?
No, they have no rational basis in reality. I mean, you can see, for example, how prevalent it's become in the pro-gun movement to compare, our American government to the Nazi regime and Stalinist Soviet Union. I mean, some of this stuff is just blatantly offensive. And you know, if you're a patriot and who loves this country, it can be quite disgusting. I don't think it has any basis in reality. Look, I mean, the fact is this. I think the pro-gun movement is a movement that really has lost all faith in our Constitution. When people believe that the only way to preserve freedom in the United States is to basically threaten to kill their own elected officials, that to me is a group of people that have no faith in the work of our founding fathers. Our Constitution has been tested over time. There's been times when we've had to go and amend that document, and our founders, you know, obviously included a self-repair mechanism in the document itself for that purpose. But let's be clear. It's what withstood the challenges presented to it. We've been through tremendously tough times in this country, tremendous crises, far greater than what we're facing today at times, and we've come through it. And that document has stood the test of time. Our system of government has lived up to its billing. It remains a model for all other free societies across the world. So I don't think it's legitimate type ideology or thinking. You know, I think it's being promoted by a gun lobby that believes that that type of ideology can help promote the sales of assault weapons.
Right. And what is really painful about it, I mean, for many of us as witnesses, is that it looks like an arms race. So you've got these insurrectionists doing their caching of assault weapons and their rhetoric about how the government is out to get them. And then you have the militarization of the police, which is also really scary for a lot of people who aren't insurrectionists at all.
Yeah, that's something that, Milwaukee Police Chief Ed Flynn was up on Capitol Hill testifying in a Senate hearing the other day, and he was talking about this. I mean, we've seen, going back decades in this country, the exact type of arms race you're describing. Chief Flynn the other day was saying, you know, when he started on this force something like 20, 25 years ago, he was carrying a six-shot revolver with him on duty, on patrol. Now, you know, you have cops that are carrying semi-automatic handguns, and, you know, they've got a assault weapon in the cruiser, you know, in case they encounter a criminal with that type of firepower. And that's exactly what we're seeing. We're seeing an arms race between cops and criminals, but also we're seeing, you know, insurrectionist pro-gun activists stockpiling these weapons against our own government. And let's be clear, too. One of the things that our organization has compiled is what we call the insurrectionism timeline. And we've been doing this since 2008 and cataloging all the incidents of people who have threatened government, holding this insurrectionist view of the Second Amendment, and in some cases where this has exploded into real-world violence, where you've had attacks on cops, guys crashing planes into government buildings and other things. So this is not hypothetical. You know, you can look back at what happened in Oklahoma City and see some of the more high-profile incidents, but let's be clear, these are threats and violence that continues in our society today. And it's something that we need to keep a very close eye on and that we should be talking more about.
What do we have already in terms of gun control laws or anti-gun violence laws, for example, in terms of background checks? Do we have anything at this point in terms of federal law?
Yeah. I mean, we have basically what we have in this country in terms of gun sales and gun commerce is a parallel set of systems where if you are a federally licensed gun dealer under our law, you are required to conduct background checks and maintain records of sale. And supposedly, these are people who are, quote unquote, engaged in the business of dealing firearms. If you are not, quote unquote, engaged in the business of dealing firearms, you are allowed as a private individual to sell guns without background checks or maintaining any records of sale to other people in 40 or more states in this country. What does it mean exactly to be engaged in the business of dealing firearms? Well, the law never really defined that. We don't know what that means in terms of, let's say, your annual income from gun sales. And the broader problem is that there is no federal agency or government agency monitoring your income to see if, let's say, gun sales are your principal source of livelihood. No one knows that. The only way they'd find out, let's say, if you're at the gun show every weekend selling guns, is if your guns begin to turn up on crime scenes. So, you know, I think we need to be clear here. The National Rifle Association and the gun lobby, they have legalized the black market in this country. When you have individuals selling guns between one another without even really knowing each other's names, cash and carry, that's legalizing black market sales. That's giving individual sellers, the ability to arm people who are obviously dangerous with no accountability whatsoever. And, you know, it's led to horrific consequences at some points. I mean, you can look back to the Columbine killings, of course, with those guns coming from a Denver gun show, or you can look at a more recent mass shooting in Wisconsin where a guy who was banned under federal law from buying guns because he was under an active domestic abuse restraining order was able to go to armslist.com and buy a gun through a private sale there, which he used to kill a bunch of women with. So it's a very serious problem, and it's something we should have repaired in our law decades ago. It's an absolute shame.
So that's what we call the gun show loophole and, I guess, the online sales loophole. What about retail stores like Walmart and other stores where you can walk into the store and buy a gun?
Well, those would be federally licensed dealers. Those would be, if you're running a gun store with a storefront and whatnot, it would be hard to hide from detection and not have to be licensed. I mean, obviously that would come under, federal government monitoring and they'd have to get a federal license. The bigger problem, though, is that, you know, it's not just gun shows. You know, it could be that you go out to the local gun show and buy from a private seller there. It could be, like we talked about a minute ago, through some online site where you organize it. It could be through a classified ad in a newspaper. In a lot of states, I could meet you on a street corner and sell you three AK-47s without even knowing your name, cash and carry. Ferry or in a McDonald's parking lot, wherever. I mean, use your imagination. So it's far broader than gun shows. It's private sales that can occur virtually anywhere.
So those private sales that can occur virtually anywhere aren't going to be affected by any laws that we pass.
Oh, sure they will. I mean, let's be clear here. There are already 17 states in this country that regulate private sales to some extent. Some of them have universal background checks on private sales. So, yeah, I mean, we could pass a law tomorrow at the federal level and regulate all these sales and hold sellers accountable when they sell guns without conducting background checks. So, no, absolutely not. We could regulate this immediately. It's something we should have been regulating decades ago. You know, the problem now is that we allow sellers to sell this gun, get guns in this manner, with no accountability under the law. And that's just, again, that's not something that any other modern free society allows citizens to do. It's ridiculous.
We're talking to Ladd Everett of the Coalition to Stop Gun Violence. Well, let's talk about other countries. Which countries regulate guns well and therefore have a lower rate of death by gun and actually reduce violence? And which countries don't? Let's look at the sort of bigger picture outside of the U.S.
Well, I mean, you can look at any other modern democracy in the world and you'll see tougher gun laws on the books than we have, and you'll see astronomically lower gun death rates. I mean, we talked a minute ago about the United Kingdom, which has a gun death rate 30 times lower and an overall homicide rate 3 times lower. There's been a lot of talk recently about Australia and what they did after a horrific mass shooting there in 1997, where they enacted very strict regulations on semi-automatic rifles and literally have not had a mass shooting in that country since. And that's been quite some time since they enacted those laws. So, you know, again, we're really, in terms of the overall picture here among free countries on the face of the earth, we really are the outlier. There is no other modern democracy on this planet that has the type of daily, horrific, gruesome shootings that we are seeing here.
When the Sandy Hook shooting happened, I got an email from a friend of mine in Germany, and he said, you need to understand that, in Germany we can own guns, but we have very strict laws about gun storage. They have to be kept in a safe in your house. Yeah. And he said, you guys need to look at gun storage. Is that something that we're looking at as a country?
Well, I mean, it's not something that we've acted on, and it was certainly a factor, obviously, in the Newtown shootings, where, you know, Nancy Lanza, on one hand, was telling her neighbors that she had a son who was quote unquote unstable and who clearly was, and then in the other, she was putting an arsenal right under his nose that he had free access to, and she was taking him shooting. But the problem was in Connecticut, I mean, and in just about every other state in this country, there's no laws regarding the mandatory safe storage of firearms in the home. So, I mean, no, it's really not something we've acted on. There are very, very few jurisdictions in this country that would require you to store your weapons at home in a safe manner, even when you have children at home, even when you have individuals struggling with mental health issues in your home. So, you know, like you mentioned, that's something that would be common in other free societies, but which, you know, the NRA and the gun lobby has prevented us from really looking at here.
One thing that somebody said recently that made so much sense to me is that the laws for owning guns should be at least as strong as the laws for driving a car. You have to pass the driver's test and get a license and things like that. Why can't we do at least that? I mean, safety classes and going through what would be the equivalent of a driver's license for gun ownership.
We should. We should and we will. I want to be clear about that. We are going to do this one day and save lives and get this done. And we absolutely should. I mean, a couple of points on that. Number one, let's be clear. The well-regulated militia at that time was indeed a well-regulated militia. These were not individuals that were just handed muskets and told to run out into the woods and shoot people. These were units that had officer structures that drilled, trained, and mustered. These were individuals that if they did not serve those functions properly could be punished. They could be court-martialed. They could be fined. They could receive corporal punishment. So this was not a joke. This was not something that was taken lightly and basically you just got your gun and did what you want with it. These were highly regulated units that were under the authority of state governments. So I think the NRA has just twisted the debate so much that that's fundamentally been lost. But on the issue of auto regulation, I mean, I think it's a fabulous model for what we should be doing with guns. If we go back a generation and look at, automobile fatality rates in the 50s, let's say, they were far higher per capita than they were today. And there was a movement launched, a wonderful consumer safety movement launched in the 1960s to really begin pressuring automobile companies and government officials to begin regulating things like drivers, cars, our roads for safety. That regulation was hard. I mean, and that was not an easy battle. Car companies originally fought that tooth and nail the same way the gun industry is fighting us now. But they won that battle. Things like automobile safety now are secondhand things for car companies. They pride themselves on those type of innovations. But that was hard. That was hard won. That wasn't just given to us. And as a result, if you look, comparing us to back in the 1960s, we were able to dramatically reduce the automobile fatality rate in this country. And sadly, we're now very close to reaching a point in this country where the gun death rate is for the first time going to exceed the automobile fatality rate. We can do a lot better in regulating firearms in this country, and we have to.
One of the things that helped with the automobile death situation was a national, I can't remember exactly what it's called, but a national highway safety database in which this information was studied and collected and gathered and analyzed, and then basically conclusions could be drawn and policies could be made. And I think one of the things that I learned through preparing to talk to you is that that kind of research has been suppressed by the NRA. We did have that kind of research on the part of the Centers for Disease Control, and it was somehow squelched. What happened, and where are we now with that?
No, yeah, you make a good point. I mean, if you go back to, I think it was around sometime between maybe 2000 and 2003, the NRA attached a rider to the CDC appropriations bill that basically prevented them from using federal funding to release any research that would, quote unquote, promote or advocate for gun control. So basically what that stopped the CDC from doing was issuing any study that argued that gun laws are effective, which is utterly ridiculous. And it was a direct response to the fact that the CDC for years had been issuing studies that showed that we had rates of gun death dramatically higher than other democracies, that our gun laws were ineffective, and that this was a public health crisis. And the NRA wanted to basically silence that commentary, and were very effective in doing so by attaching that rider to the CDC budget, which is again shamefully still attached to their budget. And then just a year or two ago, they added that rider to the National Institutes of Health budget, and basically to any other federal health agency that would issue those types of reports. Again, that should be offensive to anyone who's a patriot. That should be offensive to any American who believes in the general principle of freedom of information and how important that is for citizens of a democracy. This is something I find absolutely outrageous. And I'm glad and very happy that the vice president and others have really been talking about this and how ridiculous this is. And I think it's something that we will get fixed and soon.
One of the things that before the Centers for Disease Control research was squelched, one of the things it found out was that households with guns were more likely to have homicides and suicides than households without guns. I mean, it seems obvious, but you actually need the data in order to demonstrate this.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, that research is out there, though. I mean, again, it is not as if all research has been squelched. There, you can look at places like the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health or Harvard's Injury Control Research Center. So, I mean, there's good institutions out there doing the research. And like you said, going back years, all the peer-reviewed research we shows that when you have a gun in your house, that weapon is far more likely to be used to kill or harm you or one of your loved ones than any prospective home invader.
And so the myth that guns keep you safer in your home is not really true.
Of course it's not true. I mean, no, again, all the data that we have going back decades shows that it's not true, and the you know, the saddest irony of this is that I don't know any American who bought into this poisonous lie about guns making us safer more than Nancy Lanza. And, you know, and look what happened to her.
Oh, boy. I mean, this culture of people who really love guns, they talk about the Second Amendment, but you have very eloquently talked about how it really isn't rooted in the Second Amendment. Is it really just NRA lobbying on behalf of gun company profits? I mean, is that at the root of this gun-loving culture?
Well, I think it's a couple of things. I mean, I think it's I think it is the power of the National Rifle Association, which I think is finally being exposed as the myth it is. The NRA got, you know, absolutely shellacked in the November 2012 elections. Their primary PAC performed worse than any PAC in the nation, getting 0.8% return on investment. And I think people even before Newtown were beginning to see that in reality they're a paper tiger, that there's a lot of blustering and bullying and threats, but in reality, they're not able to deliver for candidates the way they claim they can. But, you know, I think the broader point is that this has been happening for some time in terms of kind of the radicalization of the pro-gun movement. A woman named Joan Berbick wrote what I think is really the best book on this called Gun Show Nation, where she talked about, you know, going back to the 1960s, about how guns really became a powerful token and symbol for the conservative movement in this country, you know, motivating what we now see as the modern conservative movement, a token of anti-government fervor, a token that was used to really reassign blame that many white Americans felt during the civil rights era in this country in the 1960s, a token that was used to react to threats about crime in cities that was felt by many after some of the rioting in American cities following some of the horrific assassinations we saw during that period. So I think this is something that the conservative movement has used for some time to generally stoke anti-government sentiment, which serves, I think, for them a variety of purposes, because, you know, it's a movement that really is intent on weakening government power, on extending corporate power, and I think, you know, the guns have just become a powerful token and symbol of that that motivates people. And, you know, again, I want to make it clear, I don't think it's a majority of gun owners. I think most gun owners, and I think polling has shown this clearly, are moderate people who, you know, own firearms for perfectly legitimate purposes, whether that's home defense or sporting purposes, and who see probably a lot of this as crazy, like many of the rest of us do. But, you know, again, I think when you look at the pro-gun movement, when you look at people who are more conservative in outlook or out on the far right wing, you know, I think this type of ideology is a real motivator, and I think it's been used effectively by the National Rifle Association really as a fundraising tool for many, many years.
We're talking to Ladd Everett of the Coalition to Stop Gun Violence. So, to what extent are violent video games a real part of gun violence, if they are? And what is the relationship between gun manufacturers and video game manufacturers?
Well, you know, I think violence in popular entertainment and popular culture is a factor. You know, I certainly don't want to say it's not. You know, I am certainly disturbed by much of the violence I see in video games and also, you know, in movies and music. And I think I'd be the first person to argue that as a nation, we really need a movement for nonviolence in this country. We really need to begin to teach our children, you know, to resolve conflicts nonviolently, to not turn to violence as a first solution. That said, though, I mean, I think we need to be realistic about the overall picture. I mean, if you look at, for example, young people in Britain, in Japan, and other modern democracies, they are playing the same violent video games that our kids are. But again, those societies have astronomically lower rates of gun death. So I don't think the entire solution is there, but, you know, but I think violence feeds violence, and I think at some point we do have to come to grips with this and begin to talk as a society about the message that we send kids, and you know, wouldn't we rather be teaching them that there are better ways to resolve conflicts? in terms of the linkage between gun manufacturers and video game manufacturers, I mean, you know, there have been commentators recently who have explored that. I mean, there certainly are linkages. I mean, if you look at, you know, some of the newer video games coming out, certainly, I mean, you have extensive corporate involvement in those games, even to the point where now through some of these games you can begin to, you know, directly access the websites of gun manufacturers through the game. So, you know, I think there certainly is that linkage. There was a lot of commentary, too, about a iPhone game that the NRA released, a violent iPhone game the NRA released just days after Newtown. So, that's definitely going on. I think, you know, in terms of the NRA's criticism of violent video games, that's a that there's a little bit of wagging the dog going on there. I mean, they're certainly promoting this on one hand while criticizing it on the other.
We've talked a little bit about some legislation that the NRA has lobbied for and gotten passed, but let's talk about that in more detail. Tell us some of the laws that have actually gotten passed that citizens might not know about as a result of NRA lobbying, and how that has affected U.S. society.
Well, I mean, some of the main ones over the years would be, I mean, one of the very important ones is the 1986 Firearm Owners Protection Act, which really significantly weakened enforcement of gun laws in this country. It really weakened the ATF's authority to go after corrupt gun dealers in many different areas, and which also, you know, created some of these very vague definitions in law as to who would be engaged in the business of dealing firearms and then allowing private individuals to sell guns with little or no accountability. So that was one of the major ones. You know, the NRA also fought the enactment of the Brady Law for years and years and years. They fought the enactment of the assault weapons ban. The NRA is the major reason why the assault weapons ban was not renewed. In 2005, President Bush signed an NRA-drafted law that gave the gun industry unprecedented immunity from negligence-based lawsuits, to the point where gun violence survivors can no longer sue the gun industry when their products are marketed and distributed in a negligent manner. You know, such lawsuits in the past had been effective, for example, after the D.C. sniper shootings, where the store that armed the snipers had lost something like 238 guns in 3 years that they couldn't account for, and the families in that case won a $1 million settlement suing that store and Bushmaster Firearms. So, you know, these are the types of lawsuits that are no longer possible under the law, and that's just shameful. I mean, the gun industry has essentially denied Americans their right to their day in court. So, you know, those are a few of the high-profile things, but, I mean, you know, that's just looking at the federal level. I mean, you can also certainly look at the overwhelming damage that the NRA has done to state gun laws as well.
What are some examples of that?
Well, you know, the most high-profile example, obviously, you know, in the last year or so would be Stand Your Ground. That's one that people have really talked about, you know, the weakening of laws regarding the use of lethal force, both in the home and out on the streets and in public. So, you know, that's one that's drawn a lot of attention. You know, this reform that basically removes people's duty to retreat from a public confrontation, even when they can do so safely, even when they can safely walk away, go home, and sleep it off. It allows them to stand in and kill other human beings. So that's the one that's drawn a lot of attention, but, you know, it goes far broader than that. Another one that's drawn a lot of attention, of course, is the NRA's continuing campaign to try to force colleges and universities to allow guns in classrooms and in dorms, which is extremely dangerous.
It seems like it's dangerous in the same way that having a gun in your house is dangerous. You think it's going to be to kill the bad guy, but it's going to end up being used on the people who are supposed to be protected.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and that's the reality. And again, you know, when we think of Newtown, we need to get that point through our head. There is no American that I have ever heard of who bought into the guns make us safer, you know, myth more than Nancy Lanza. The woman was sitting on an arsenal of firearms. And let's be very clear. The day before that shooting happened, the NRA and every other pro-gun activist in this country would have told us that Nancy Lanza was the safest woman in America. But it didn't quite work out that way. And very often, the gun you buy and you're fantasizing about shooting some guy in a ski mask who comes through your house, that gun is far more likely to be used, let's say, by your kid who's depressed and commits suicide, or by you in a moment of anger when you kill someone that you either know or may even love. So, I mean, that's the reality of gun violence in America. If you look at FBI Uniform Crime Report data, it is fascinating. And what it shows is that in 79% of homicides, the person who commits the murder and who is killed know each other. They are not strangers. They are people who know each other. In 25% of homicides, they're family members. And approximately 40% of these homicides involve, they start from simple arguments over things like money, property, relationships. So, you know, the NRA has created this myth that the acts of violence you're most likely to see is the guy jumping through your window with the ski mask. That is just, in a reality-based conversation, that doesn't fly.
So what have President Obama and his administration done since the Sandy Hook massacre, and what kind of legislation is being considered in Congress?
The president has taken historic action in the wake of the Sandy Hook shooting to address this problem. The president has issued a remarkably comprehensive package of reforms to finally really address this epidemic of gun violence we're seeing, which includes things like universal background checks, requiring background checks on all gun sales, which includes renewing the assault weapons ban and the ban on high-capacity ammunition magazines. He's implemented something along the lines of 23 executive orders, which would vastly improve the enforcement of gun laws in this country, and record sharing between federal agencies to strengthen background checks. So, that's been an effort that's been very serious, which has brought many different players to the table to contribute their own input, including gun violence survivors, who have been, I think, chronically ignored in this debate in a way that's really unfortunate, and that's finally now changed. And these reforms, I'm happy to say, are now being actively considered in the Senate. The Senate Judiciary Committee just held its third hearing on these proposals yesterday. A very emotional, very robust conversation occurred there, and the Senate Judiciary Committee will be marking up that legislation shortly. And hopefully we will have a strong package of reforms that go to the Senate floor for votes.
Is this issue of gun violence still pretty much completely drawn along partisan lines?
To a large extent, yeah. I mean, I think, you know, I don't want to limit this to guns. I think, you know, there's been a lot of commentary about how the modern Republican Party has moved farther to the right wing over time. If you go back, even to when I was a young man, the moderate Republicans and even some liberal Republicans were not an extinct species. I mean, that was a reality. You had, many Republican elected officials who were much more moderate in their political outlook. Those folks, again, are now endangered, if not non-existent. So, and I think that's affected, the dialogue on a number of different issues, and it goes well beyond guns to things, that even in the past used to be quite basic, including, obviously basic fiscal and economic considerations. So, that's a factor, though. And it's tougher, certainly, in the past than it's been to get Republican support for gun violence prevention measures. That said, though, I don't think it's impossible. I think you've seen many positive comments from Republican politicians since Newtown about being open to the idea of finally taking action in terms of implementing gun reform. And I think you have some productive efforts going on right now in Congress to bring Democrats and Republicans together to work on legislation that can be passed in both chambers, in the House and Senate. One that I would note off the bat would be the effort in the Senate right now between folks like Senator Joe Manchin, a conservative Democrat from West Virginia, and Tom Coburn, a Republican from Oklahoma, to hammer out a deal on background checks for all gun sales. So, I think that kind of conversation is healthy. And, I think we need to have all voices. We need to have, everyone in this debate and actively talking about what we can do here.
You mentioned a moment ago that the NRA PAC got very little return on its investment in the last set of elections. Do you see their power? I mean, it's a vast power, but do you see it diminishing?
It's definitely diminishing, yeah. I mean, it's absolutely diminishing. I mean, again, looking back on the 2012 election, I mean, they just got hammered. They got nearly shut out, really, and they spent a lot of money. And, you know, I think people who look very carefully in terms of data at this myth they perpetuated that they're invincible have for a long time seen that it's not true. But I think 2012, the election then, really just confirmed that in a way that was just glaringly obvious. And then, you know, I would point you to an election that just happened the other night where in Illinois, A-rated NRA candidate trying to get the Democratic nomination for Congress there got lost in a landslide election there to a candidate who favored positive gun reform. And one of the key factors there was a new PAC from Mayor Mike Bloomberg from New York City, who's the co-chair of Mayors Against Illegal Guns, who ran a number of ads in that district going after the A-rated NRA candidate there. And he was able to make guns the primary issue in that contest. So I think it's a couple of different things. I think it's a newfound fervor among grassroots activists on our side, on the side of gun violence prevention, people who now are matching the energy level of people, who love guns sometimes more than human life. But I think, too, it's the fact that, you know, even when you look at the campaign finance picture, that picture is now dramatically changed with the emergence of Mayor Bloomberg's PAC, which is only going to get more involved in the gun issue over time, and also with the emergence of a new PAC from Gabby Giffords and her husband, Mark Kelly, Americans for Responsible Solutions. So if you're now a politician who in the past would take NRA money and then think, well, you know, yeah, I can go along with this. I'm certainly not going to be facing any money on the other side. Well, guess what? You now have some other things to think about when you run for office.
It seems like one of the things that doesn't really get talked about that much is that there's got to be a gender issue in here. I mean, there aren't as many women who are kind of rabidly pro-gun by nature. Is the women's voice being heard in this debate?
I think what's very interesting right now is that, you know, the gun issue is now becoming the next big women's issue. You know, there's been a lot of talk lately, obviously, about reproductive choice and women's response to that and how they're playing a key factor in elections being motivated on that issue. I think in the wake of Newtown, though, and it'll be fascinating to see what happens in the 2014 midterm elections, I think you're going to see the gun issue become a key motivator for women. And I think women are going to hold politicians accountable on this issue. One of the things we need to note here is that when you look at national polling, women have always been much more strongly for gun control than men have. I mean, really, notably more strong. So, again, I think this could be the next big women's issue of the 21st century.
Very interesting. We've just got a minute or two left. Is there anything else that you want to let our listeners know before we go?
The only thing I'd like to say is, you know, if you are a resident who's become, you know, very concerned about this issue in the wake of Newtown, get involved, begin to speak out, do something. Don't feel like this is helpless. There is positive change now happening across this country, and you can certainly be part of it. And for those who, want to contact our organization, if we can connect you with local activists on the ground, we'd be happy to. Our email is csgv@csgv.org.
And CSGV stands for the Coalition to Stop Gun Violence. Ladd Everett is the communications director for that organization. I want to thank you so much for spending all this time with us on the Radio Cafe.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.